University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Parker Palmer, an independent writer, teacher, and activist, and his lecture, The Violence of Our Knowledge Toward a Spirituality of Higher Education. Palmer's lecture will examine public perceptions on violence and expectations of who is violent. With special interests in the areas of education, community, spirituality, and social change, the Madison, Wisconsin resident travels throughout the United States and the world conducting workshops, lectures, and retreats. A senior associate of the American Association of Higher Education, Palmer has been featured in the New York Times and the Chronicle of Higher Education and on the CBS television program Night Watch. He has authored poems, essays, and four books, including The Promise of Paradox, published in 1990. Palmer received his bachelor's degree from Carleton College in Minnesota and his master's and doctorate from the University of California, Berkeley, with additional study at the Union Theological Seminary in New York. Join us now for University Forum and Dr. Parker Palmer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for coming. I want to talk to you for the next 50 minutes about a problem that I think is arguably the central problem of our time. The name of the problem is violence. I don't think you have to go much farther than the morning newspaper or the evening TV news to know how critical the issue of violence is in American life and around the world. We seem to have a penchant, a tendency for solving every issue that faces us by the use of violence. And I want to be clear as I start that when I talk about violence, I'm not simply talking about those horrendous scenes from what once was Yugoslavia, where people are slaughtering each other, men, women, and children, without regard for human life. I'm not simply talking about the babies that are dying today in the inner city for want of a just economic system. I'm also talking about the kind of violence that we polite folks do to each other, even in the Midwest, day in and day out. I'm talking about violence as a human activity, which I will offer a simple definition of. We do violence when we violate the integrity of the other. We do violence when we violate the integrity and identity of the other. We do violence when we listen to someone speak and then dismiss what they have to say because you can't possibly know anything, you're only young, or you can't possibly know anything, you're only old, or you can't possibly know anything, you're only a woman, or what do you know, you're only black. Or how can you possibly speak, you're gay or lesbian? Those are violent attitudes. They don't involve dropping bombs or hitting people with sticks, but they involve violating the integrity and identity of the other. And we do it all the time. We do it inside ourselves, we do it between ourselves, and we rip apart the community in which we were meant to live and thrive. Now, there are lots of roots of violence. If you ask yourself, where does violence come from, there are hundreds of scholars who are ready to give you answers. People will talk about the economic roots of violence. They'll talk about the political roots of violence, the psychological roots of violence. I want to talk this morning about a source of violence that I don't think we consider very often, and that source is in how we educate. The source of violence I want to talk about is what goes on in higher education day in and day out. I want to talk about how we understand knowledge and knowing and how that gets translated into classroom practice. I want to talk about how students in the American higher education system are deformed by the violence of their own learning, by the violence of their own knowledge. This may seem like reaching a bit, But I have a real concern about how we treat these problems in higher education. I think what we do with the problem of violence is always to look elsewhere for its sources, for its roots. We're ready to criticize politicians. We're ready to criticize unjust economics. We're ready to criticize those people who try to solve their problems with swords and bombs. But we're not willing to do what the Quakers and other pacifists have always urged us to do, which is to look within ourselves, to look within our own communities and our own institutions for the seeds of violence that we plant every day in our lives. So it's that kind of mirror that I'd like to hold up this morning to the very practices of higher education under the title The Violence of Our Knowledge. This is a problem that has a long history in American higher education. And I've brought with me this morning a story that I recently discovered that I think will demonstrate how old this history is, how far back the roots of this problem go. This is a very remarkable true story. It comes from the year 1744, almost 250 years ago. And it's a story about the white commissioners of Maryland and Virginia who had just established William and Mary College, offering the Indians in that region a chance to send their young people to William and Mary. Here it seemed, I'm sure, to the white commissioners was a golden opportunity for these Indians, people they would have regarded as poor, naked savages living in the woods, to get real learning and even to get a degree that might get them somewhere in the world. So they offered a free education to the young people of this tribe. The elders of the tribe sat down and considered their offer way back in 1744. And the next day they wrote back these words to the white commissioners of Maryland and Virginia, the board of trustees of William and Mary College. I want you to listen to this voice of the Native American from 250 years ago and hear the wisdom that's in it. The elders speak. "We know that you, white commissioners, highly esteem the kind of learning taught in those colleges. We know that the maintenance of our young people while with you would be very expensive to you. We are convinced that you mean to do us good by your proposal, and we thank you heartily. But you are wise, and you must know that different nations have different conceptions of things, and we hope you will not take it amiss if our ideas about education happen to be different from yours. We have had some experience of it. Time was when we sent several of our young people to your colleges in the northern provinces. They got instructed in all of your sciences, but when they came back to us, they were bad runners, ignorant of every means of living in the woods, neither fit for hunters, warriors, nor counselors. They were totally good for nothing." These elders go on to say, "We are, however, nonetheless obliged by your kindness and your offer, though we decline to accept it. But to show our gratitude to you, if the gentlemen of Virginia will send us a dozen of their children, we will take care of their education, instruct them in all we know, and make real grown-ups of them." Now that's an extraordinary document from 250 years ago, not only because of the gentle humor and the deep wisdom in it, but because it reveals a fundamental struggle that goes on to this day in our institutions of higher learning. Those Native American elders knew something that we have forgotten or refused to know. They knew that there is no such thing as a neutral form of education. They know that there is no such thing as a set of facts which are simply facts to which we can then add certain values. They knew that there was no such thing as a technical education which is not at the same time an education that will form or deform the human soul. Those Native Americans knew that in their relation to the white commissioners of Maryland and Virginia, they were in a battle. And the battle was not simply about who would occupy the territory and who would get to use the natural resources. The battle was about whose mode of knowing would dominate, because they knew that every way of knowing becomes a way of living. And they knew that the way of knowing promoted by William and Mary College, which is the direct ancestor of this college and every other college in the country, that mode of knowing was not a mode of knowing that made for fit adult life according to the ethic and value of Native American people. They understood something that we have forgotten. It is that there is no such thing as neutral facts. Every factual education contains within it an ethical formation or deformation. They knew that every way of knowing becomes a way of living. William and Mary's way of knowing won. It is the dominant way of knowing in American higher education. I want to look at that way of knowing, and I want to explore with you for a while the deformations that come with it. I want to explore the way our dominant way of knowing, teaching, and learning deforms our ethical lives and poises us to do violence in the world. I want then to talk briefly about our spiritual traditions, including the one in which this college is rooted, an alternative conception of knowing that is in those spiritual traditions, an alternative conception that is perhaps closer to what the Native Americans were fighting to protect and nurture as an antidote to what we have today. Let me start with a look at the dominant way of knowing in American higher education. It's a way that I call objectivism, and it has some very simple premises. The premise of our way of knowing is that you cannot know anything truly and well until you have held it at a distance and made an object out of it. You cannot know anything truly and well, whether it's a piece of history, a piece of human behavior, a body of literature, some data about biological life. You cannot know anything truly and well until you have distanced it from yourself and made of it an object of analysis. In this way of knowing, there is a profound distrust of subjectivity. This is a way of knowing that, unlike the Native Americans, says everything that is within us, everything that is subjective, is suspect. It is biased, it is prejudiced, it is darkness, it is error. And if we let our subjectivity slop over onto these objects of pure knowledge, we will not have the truth. So the whole program of higher education is to teach us to know things at a distance. We know the world at a distance. We know nature at a distance. We know texts at a distance. Because our task is to get far enough away from them that our subjectivity will not slop over on them and destroy the purity of what we know. There's a second thing that happens in this, which is that once you've made an object out of something, you analyze it. You chop it up into pieces to see what makes it tick. The analog would be the growing flower that gets plucked up every day to see what makes it grow. Problem being that in the course of analyzing it, the thing gets killed. But when you've made an object out of something, it's dead already. So you're free to cut it up into little pieces and to analyze how it operates. And there's a third feature. In addition to this distance, this analysis, there's what we call experimentation. That is, once you've made an object out of something and cut it up into pieces, the experimental way of knowing is to move those pieces around to see if you can't configure them differently, usually in a shape that is more pleasing to your design of how things ought to be. I'm not just talking here about laboratory experiments in science. Indeed, as I hope to show later, science is not in reality done in this objectivist model. Science is a richer and deeper way of knowing than that. But I'm talking about the kind of experimentation we conduct, for example, with the third world. We have for years treated third world cultures as objects to be studied and analyzed. And then we experiment with them. We say, what if we put a little piece of our economy or our political system into yours and see what the results might be? We think we could make a country that we'd be happier dealing with if we did it that way. Or what if we put an element or a dimension of our religious belief system into the middle of yours? We think we would create a system that we'd be happier dealing with that way. We have a history of experimenting with other people's cultures as if they were objects simply to be analyzed and manipulated, because that's the way we are taught to treat the world. And you don't need to go very far in the third world to find people who will say, you have done violence to us. Your politicians have done violence to us. Your economists have done violence to us. Your missionaries have done violence to us. Because we are formed in a way of knowing that permits us to treat the world as an object to be dissected and experimented upon. It's a profound deformation in our way of knowing, and therefore in our way of living. And it's exactly the deformation that the Native Americans 250 years ago were fighting against. Now, if all of this seems a little abstract and theoretical, let me tell a couple of stories that may indicate it has real-life implications. I'll tell a couple of stories about other people and one about myself. Some of you may have seen a film a few years back called The Day After Trinity. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to see it. It's a film created by public television, which reviews the lives of the great scientists who created the first atomic explosion at Alamogordo, New Mexico. These men, and they were all men, 40 years after that event, are reflecting on their involvement in this incredible moment of 20th century history, when the power of the atom was released and human relationships on the face of this earth changed forever. What's impressive about the film is that if you are a pacifist as I am, you come away from that film unable to hate these people. They are deeply human people, struggling with profound moral issues. I wish people in the pacifist community would struggle as deeply as some of these scientists and mathematicians have with the morality of their own action. You come away with deep respect for these men who were drawn almost unknowingly into one of the most important moments of 20th century history, and you see the anguish and the agony that is on their faces. One of the most agonizing moments in that film comes when a mathematician comes on the screen. And please hear this for the power that's in it. He comes on the screen and he says, you know, the day before we pushed the button on that first nuclear weapon, we mathematicians had done calculations that indicated that there was a small but very real chance that when we pushed the button, the entire envelope of oxygen around the Earth would be instantaneously incinerated, thereby snuffing out all life on Earth. The day before we pushed the button, we did calculations indicating that there was a small but real chance that that might happen. And he says, still, we pushed the button. How do you explain that? Do you say they were so caught up in the power and romance of what they were doing that they lost their minds? Do you say they were so seduced by the government money that was flowing through their lives? Do you say they were so caught up in the community of science that was gathered there in the New Mexico desert? Or do you say, as I'm inclined to say, that we are so deeply taught that our right relation to the world is objectifying, analyzing, and experimenting, that we are willing to use anything, including the inhabited Earth itself, as an experimental laboratory to test a hypothesis? We talk about being in possession of great knowledge. I think an equal case can be made that we are possessed by the way we know, and that we are daily conducting experiments that risk life, and indeed the entire inhabited planet, for the sake of what we call knowledge. It's the kind of thing that the Native Americans deeply feared 250 years ago, that they would be overcome by a way of knowing that so distanced them from the Earth itself that the Earth itself would be an object to be manipulated rather than a life to be revered. And we have a story from the heart of the 20th century that says the same thing. I'll tell you a second story. Every year, the Carnegie Commission conducts a survey of recent graduates of colleges and universities. And they ask a lot of questions about the attitudes and orientations of those bright, generally bright, young men and women who have recently graduated from colleges. One of those questions is, what do you think about the future of the global society? What do you think about the fate of the earth on which you live? And 90% of those young men and women say the global society is going to hell in a handbasket. The earth itself has hardly any future. 90% of them. And they're well educated. They cite chapter and verse about pollution and the collapse of governments and the weakness of economic systems and the fall of moral values. They cite chapter and verse about why the global society has very little chance of surviving. The next question is, if the world is going to hell in a handbasket, what do you think about your own personal futures? And 90% of them get a have a nice day smile on their faces and say, no problem. My personal life is fine because I'm going to this nice college and I'm getting decent grades and I'm going to find a good spouse and I'm going to make a nice home and have a good little career, and my life itself is safe and protected and sane. Now, how do you explain that? How do you explain the capacity of people, the most educated people in our society, to believe two totally contradictory things? One, that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, but the other, that they're going to be just fine. Well, I want to suggest to you that it's an ethical deformation of our educated lives. I want to suggest to you that for 18 years, young people are taught about a world that's out there somewhere rather than a world in which they live. I want to suggest to you that we objectify the world in education so profoundly that our graduates at some level truly do not know that the world they've been studying is the same one that they occupy in daily experience. I think it's a trained schizophrenia that comes about from an objectified way of knowing. I ask young people across the country, and when I'm able to get with young people in small groups where we can look each other in the eye and pay attention to each other and practice mutual respect, it's marvelous what I learn from them. And I ask them, when was the last time you were asked in the context of a classroom to tell a piece of your little story, your life story, in the setting of the big story that you're learning about? And they say, never. That doesn't happen. I'm never asked to intersect my own tale with the tale being told by the discipline, which is another way of saying I'm never asked to come to terms with the fact that this history I'm learning about, or this biology that I'm learning about, or this literature that I'm learning about is really about my life. They say that systematically. The little story doesn't get told because the objective story takes precedence, and the whole strategy in higher education is to keep subjectivity out of the equation. We don't want to hear the little story because we're afraid it will bias our knowledge. It's the objectivist agenda at work. third and final story about myself. And please listen to this and see if you have a counterpart in your own life. I was educated at some of the best colleges and graduate schools in this country. Best meaning that they practiced objectification of knowledge with great skill. And in those colleges and universities, I learned the history of the Third Reich. The Third Reich, of course, is Nazi Germany under Hitler. The Third Reich, when 6 million Jews were murdered simply because they were different. And God knows how many Christians and gypsies and persons with disabilities and homosexuals murdered for the same reason. Some historians say that the total number of such murders is probably 16 million. Those events happened, many of them, in my own lifetime. I was born in 1939. But I learned the history of those events, and please see if you can hear this image. I learned the history of those events in a way that made me feel they had happened on another planet to another species. I was taught by good historians, they were all sane and highly credentialed people, so none of them ever said other planet, other species. But they presented the data in such an objective and distanced way that the impression I was left with at a very deep level was that that story had nothing to do with my life. I did not learn that the small suburb in which I grew up, predominantly white suburb, had its own Nazi tendencies, its own way of excluding the stranger, of dismissing those who looked or spoke or thought differently. I did not learn the intersection between the story of Nazi Germany and the story of my small town. Secondly, and even more important, I did not learn that Parker Palmer has within himself a little Hitler. And I mean that quite literally. A force of darkness within me that when the difference between you and me gets too great, I want somehow to kill you. Not with a bullet or a gun, but with a name, a label, a dismissive term. You're just a jock. You're just a nuisance. You're just a Republican. You're just a this or just a that. I want to kill you off with a dismissive term that reduces and diminishes the difference between us and allows me to deal with the threat to my own life. We don't connect the little story and the big story because we are profoundly deformed by a way of knowing which objectifies, analyzes, and wants to experiment with everything. Now, what I believe is that a revolution is underway that is challenging this dominant way of knowing. I think that we live in an exciting time, if you're interested in higher education, because we are surrounded by scholars and more ordinary voices of people challenging that dominant way of knowing and trying to bring us toward what I would call an education that lends itself to peace. I hear some of those voices among feminist scholars. I hear some of those voices among black historians. I hear some of those voices among philosophers who are reflecting on subatomic physics. What is emerging from all of those fields is a new conception of knowing. And it's a conception of knowing that is not about distancing ourselves from what we know, but about entering community with it. In all of the fields I've just named, feminist scholarship, black history, the philosophy of subatomic physics, we learn that it's not really possible to make this rigid distinction between the knower and the known. It's not really possible for a human being to know anything simply at distance, simply in separation. Knowing is always a profoundly relational act. what we learn from these new philosophies of knowing is that the work of the mind is the work of building community, not breaking it. The work of the mind is the work of bringing us into relationship with that which would otherwise be unavailable, rather than shattering what little community we have left in our lives. It's an exciting thing to me to think that history taught well really allows me to use my mind to reconnect with that which only seems dead and gone, but in fact lives in me and in my psyche and in my heart. It's an exciting thing for me to think that biology taught well enables me to reconnect in community with the natural world, which is always trying to speak to me and to make some sort of claim on my life. It's an exciting thing to me to think that literature taught well is about using my mind to read a text in a way that allows the text to analyze and question and challenge me, to be in community with that text, with that history, with that natural world. Because it's only by upbuilding community through knowing, teaching, and learning that higher education will start to serve the causes of peace. Look how we normally want to teach a third world culture. We want to teach about a third world culture in a way that allows us to look at it and make judgments without ever allowing it to look back at us and question our cultural commitments. We want to teach biology in a way that allows us to look at the natural world without ever allowing the natural world to look back at us and question our consumptive lives. We want to teach literature in a way that allows students to learn what the critics have said about the text rather than to engage the text in a way that allows the text to challenge our values and beliefs. But these new ways of knowing, which are much more like the ones that the Native Americans were practicing 250 years ago, are profoundly communal and profoundly relational. And they might bring us into community with the known world in a way that would make for not violence, but a more peaceful way of life. I want to take my last 10 minutes here to say that what especially excites me about these new ways of knowing that are being written by feminists and black scholars and philosophers of science is that they seem to me deeply consistent with the best wisdom available in our spiritual traditions about how it is that human beings know. And I want, in closing, to especially make some comments about a way of knowing that I believe is at the heart of Christian tradition, at the heart of biblical understanding, because this is a college that stands somehow in that tradition, although I also understand that it has a conflicted and problematic relation with the tradition as well. Most church-related colleges do, because the fact of the matter is that frequently efforts to hook up religion and education have resulted in the detriment of education, have resulted in the diminishment of education. But I think we have to reach deep and powerfully into the best of our spiritual traditions today, because if the religious traditions have been deforming of our lives historically, those deformations are almost as nothing compared to the deformations of the objectified view of life that I've just described. We practice a religion in the American Academy, and it's called objectivism, and it needs to be challenged from every conceivable angle and source. And one of those sources is the deep wisdom of the great spiritual traditions of the world. I want to conclude by using four words that I think describe the way of knowing that is at the heart of authentic spirituality. It's a way of knowing that I think we need to be talking about on our college campuses, because I think it not only challenges objectivism, but it also offers a creative alternative, which we badly need. The first word is personal. If I ask, what are the great spiritual traditions saying about the nature of truth? I think the first thing they're saying is truth is personal. They don't say truth is propositional. The churches may say that hundreds of years later, that all of this boils down to 12 propositions that you have to believe or you don't belong. But the original impulse in those traditions is that truth is personal. That is, truth makes a claim on my life. And one of our litmus tests for teaching and learning in the college ought to be, are we teaching that which makes a claim on my life? Or are we only teaching that which allows me to live a life over here while my knowledge is over there? We ought to be asking a deep question out of spiritual tradition. Are we dealing with truth? The test being, does it make a claim on our personal lives? The Christian word for this is incarnation, embodiment. The word is that whatever I know that is of truth, I must somehow embody and incarnate. That doesn't mean I'm supposed to be perfect, but it means I have to embody the struggle to live what I know. So the claim that truth makes on my life is not just some propositions to be memorized and repeated on a test, but the personal incarnation of great ideas, great insights, great questions. But secondly, in these spiritual traditions, it's not enough for truth to be personal, because when truth is only personal, it ends up to be relativistic. It ends up to be one truth for you, another truth for me, and never mind the difference. So the second thing about truth in our great spiritual traditions is that truth is communal. And that means we struggle together to understand what's true, to challenge conceptions of what's true, to question dominant images of what's true, to reach consensus about what's true, only to know that a while later that consensus will be broken because a new voice comes into the community or a new insight happens. To do that, we have to learn to do something very simple. We have to learn to listen to each other, and we have to learn to speak to each other without fear, without embarrassment, without awkwardness, without all the shame games and other games that we play. We can't pretend to listen. We can't pretend to speak. We have to do it authentically. And that means classrooms in which community is practiced, communities of dialogue and discourse, where people learn not to be embarrassed by ideas. Classrooms in which people are formed to understand that they have minds to think with. They don't have to play around while ideas are being articulated or explored. That thinking is not embarrassing, it's a human activity. We practice community on the campus in a way that embodies the fact that truth is communal. A third thing that our spiritual traditions say is that truth is interactive. Truth is reciprocal. Truth is profoundly relational. What that means is that I'm not only pursuing truth, but truth is pursuing me. What that means is that it's not only me and my devices and my methodologies that are out there trying to track down what's true, but I have to learn in classrooms and in study and in the whole life of the mind to sit still long enough to be found out by the truth. We have this very interesting conceit in American higher education. It's in all of our college catalogs. It goes like this. This is an institution deeply dedicated to the pursuit of truth. It's a fascinating conceit. The image I have is that we think that truth is this evasive rabbit that's scampering out there across the fields, energetically trying to evade us and escape us, while we, with our hounds and horns and horses, are deeply dedicated to tracking it and killing it and eating it. The spiritual traditions know something different. The spiritual traditions know that we evade truth ourselves, that truth is in search of us, that truth wants to track us down and find us out and expose us for our bias, our ignorance, our error. And we need to learn another mode of thinking, which is receptive and open and self-searching. It's a powerful moment, I think, which we have sometimes in our ordinary experience of reading a novel written 100 years ago and suddenly wondering, how could that author, who died long before I was born, know so much about me, being tracked and found and revealed by truth? And finally, if all of the above is true, then our spiritual traditions say one more thing, and that is that truth is not only personal, communal, reciprocal, but it's also transformational. That is, it will change our lives. The poet Rilke said this, I think, with a wonderful image. He said in one of his poems, "There is no place at all that is not looking at you. You must change your life." It's a marvelous motto, I think, to be carved over the door of every academic discipline. What a thing it would be to teach political science in the knowledge that the peasants of Nicaragua are looking at us. We must change our lives. What a marvelous thing it would be to teach biology with the knowledge that the rainforests of Brazil are looking at us. We must change our lives. What a marvelous thing it would be to teach any discipline with an understanding that the world is alive and it makes a claim on us. You see, the power and seductiveness of this objectivism is that it allows us to be the only game in town. It allows us to know in a way that gives us power over. But that illusion is falling apart. We're realizing more and more that we have not been good stewards of what we know. We have not exercised our power wisely and well. And the feminists who are writing, and the black historians who are writing, and the philosophers of science who are writing in a context where we realize now that we can't simply be the changers of the world. We also need to be the changed. We need to know and to teach and to learn in a way that opens our lives to transformation, a transformation from violence to peacemaking, a transformation from competition to community, a transformation that can make life worth living and higher education, it seems to me, profoundly exciting. I believe these things are possible. I believe the map is being drawn for us. I believe our spiritual traditions have a great deal to teach us about these possibilities, and I welcome your collaboration and interest in this search. Thank you very much.
Today's speaker on University Forum has been Dr. Parker Palmer, an independent writer, teacher, and activist. His lecture was entitled, "The Violence of Our Knowledge Towards the Spirituality of Higher Education." This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational, undergraduate liberal arts institution nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.